I just want to do a little recap because we've really focused our efforts on the primordial garden, the first garden that God created and put his creatures into. And we talked the first day about how interesting it was that God created the first, as Barbara told us, earth creature, or creature ground, what was it, earth creature? Which then, when God decided that this earth creature needed a companion, took a rib out of its side, and suddenly one of them became male and one of them became female. And they were really partners. It's not this idea that God created a male man and then found out that the male man, though he was the dominator of creation, still needed a female somehow to help him out. It's much more this idea that the unity of that first creature that God created is sort of maintained in two co-equal and sexually differentiated creatures called man and woman. And it's this wonderful idea in that first reading, that first day that we did, that there's a partnership there and that everything is good in the garden. This is the way that God had intended it to be. And then, of course, yesterday we read about the problem in the garden, the chaos that enters into the garden through the snake. Eve disobeys God. Eve actually obeys the snake or trusts the snake. She believes the snake when the snake says, God doesn't really love you or care for you. God just wants to keep you from becoming one with God or as smart as God is. And that's why God doesn't want you to eat of the apple. So then Eve eats the fruit, and all of a sudden, as we said before, this judgment happens to the man and the woman. It's not that God decides to punish them in a certain way, thinking, how can I get back at them? It's more the sense that when you do something, sometimes there are consequences that come naturally out of what you do. And the fact that Eve chose against God, or chose to trust the snake, meant that these other things happened. Now, what were they? The snake is on his belly, that's clear. Eve, what happens to her?
Pain and childbearing.
And?
She
still wants to have children even though there's pain in it, or she still wants sex even though there's pain in it. And what's the third one that's a big one?
Man has to work hard.
No, for her.
Oh, for her?
Between your seed and her seed.
Between the serpent and hers, but I think she's proclaimed subservient at that point, isn't she?
Oh yeah, sure. He'll rule over you.
Yeah, he will rule over you. So suddenly, instead of this equality that was there at the beginning, we have a disequality. What happens to Adam? What happens to the man? You don't have to look it up. It's pretty simple.
He's got to go to work.
He's got to go to work. And is it going to be easy?
No.
It's going to be hard. Nothing like the garden. And what's the third thing, the big thing? The Ash Wednesday thing?
He's going to dust will return.
To dust he will return. So we have mortality enters into the good creation. But we know that it isn't just God being angry at them because of what? What does God do at the end?
He clothes them.
He clothes them. He makes them some buckskin suits and says, you know, I still love you. And so the garden, and he sets a sword before the garden and sort of suddenly the garden is no longer something that humanity is going to experience because of the choices that were made back then. Well, I just want to do a real quick survey of biblical history, because I think many of us, we hear these lessons now and then, but we don't get the whole array of things. After the Genesis, after the creation story in the fall, we have the Cain and Abel stuff, the two sons of Adam and Eve and their enmity between each other. We have the flood story with Noah, chapter 6. We have the Tower of Babel in chapter 9. Does anybody else remember any other stories in there before chapter 12? Chapter 12 is really where we come to a point where there's a real difference in the kinds of stories. Before chapter 12, we have stories that are rich in mythological feel. That is, they have a much more of a sense that it doesn't deal with factual material, but rather deals with material that is explaining the way things got to be the way they are. And so we don't think of Noah, for example, as having been a real flesh and blood person, but rather Noah is more of a representation of man, humanity, going through a time of disobedience, destruction, and God's making a covenant with him. But when you come to Adam, when you come to Abraham and Sarah, you come into history. Suddenly you break into a whole different kind of writing in the Old Testament. And you know that Abraham is invited by God or called by God to come to a new land, and he obeys that and therefore becomes the so-called father of the country, of the Israelites. He and Sarah have a child late in their life, Isaac. Isaac marries Rachel? Rebecca, right. Isaac marries Rebecca and has two sons, Jacob and Esau. And Jacob marries Rachel, is that right? And also Leah, and has 12 sons by the two wives. And those 12 sons become the 12 tribes of Israel. And if you remember, Joseph is gets into a situation on a wagon train down to Egypt and becomes Pharaoh's right-hand man. And then all of the other brothers go down there during a famine. The people of Israel are in Egypt for 400 years. Egypt forgets that they were good guys, makes them into slaves. And then Moses comes and brings them out of Egypt. Some interesting stuff going on at that time in relation to the garden motif, because they go into the wilderness, a very dry and dusty place, and God makes a promise to them that they're going to come into a garden place. What's that called? The land of?
Promised land.
Flowing with milk and honey.
Flowing with milk and honey, right. The promised land, yeah. And unfortunately, they are disobedient many times, and they end up spending a lot more time in the desert than they had hoped. But finally, they do come into the land of milk and honey, and if you remember the spies going into Jericho or into the promised land sent by what's his name? Joshua. Do you remember the pictures in the Sunday school books of what they found? What they found there? What kind of things they found?
Grape bunches as big as gunny sacks.
Grape bunches big as gunny sacks. Yeah, I always remember the two guys walking with this big pile of grapes on a stave between them, walking along. And it's just this mythological abundance in this land, that the garden that God created is in fact still there, and it's just there for the plucking. And so under Joshua they go in, and God provides them the victory, and they are suddenly in a promised land. There's a period of time when they're under judges living in the promised land, and the Philistines are still a problem on the borders. Then they have King Saul, first king. King David, who wipes up the Philistines, finally kills Goliath, and etc. And then King Solomon. After King Solomon, there's a breakup, if you recall, between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom is 10 tribes up north. Southern kingdom, 2 tribes to make up the 12. And not too long after that, 100 years or 200 years, in 721, the Assyrians come down and conquer that part of Israel which is most abundant and easiest to take, really, which is the northern 10 kingdoms. And they wipe them out. The Assyrians were vicious. What they did was they carted the people off and forced them to intermarry with the Assyrians so that the identity of those Jewish people was lost. And that's why it's possible for the Mormons to say that the 10 tribes of Israel that disappeared ended up in America. Is that what they say? Who knows any Mormon theology? I know there's something.
Some of them in Mexico, I think, the groups supposed to have been by according to Mormon.
Uh-huh. But something about the 10 lost tribes ending up as Indians in the United States, and yes. Jesus came over and preached to the 10 lost tribes, the Indians. Which is not Lutheran theology, by the way.
Only the theology.
But the destruction of the North sets the tone for what we have today, which is we want to read about the garden motif, which is now a vineyard, in the book of Isaiah. Isaiah is preaching to the people of Judah which is around Jerusalem, the two tribes that are still left, very powerful tribes, I might add. And he's talking to them about how vulnerable they are and how much they need to trust in God and what could happen if they don't trust in God. So why don't we turn to Isaiah chapter 5. Isaiah is about a little bit beyond the middle of the Bible. Chapter 5. And what I'd like to do is read it, verse 1 and 2, and then somebody else 3 and 4, somebody else 5 and 6, and somebody else 7. So four readers.
Now let me sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved, a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. He dug it up and cleared out its stones and planted with the choicest vine. He built a tower in its midst and also made a winepress in it. So he expected it to bring forth good grapes, but it brought forth wild grapes.
And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I pray you, between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard? And I have not done in it. When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes?
And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. And I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed. And briars and thorns shall grow up. I will also command the clouds, and they rain no rain upon it.
For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. And he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed; for righteousness, but behold, a cry. Woe to those who join house to house, who add field to field, until there is no more room.
Nope, time out.
Oh.
Just verse 7.
That was it.
That is regard the last few sentences.
Forget those.
No, you have to take them back word by word. Right. Field to field, add who, house to house, join who, those to woe.
What does that mean anyway? That sounds like modern agriculture.
Yeah, no, let's not talk about it. That might get too close to home. Woe to us. So, who knows anything about vineyards? Anybody work on a vineyard, or anybody have some grapes in their backyard?
I've been living in a couple vineyards in California.
Mm-hmm. Were you working there?
Took a tour.
Mm-hmm. Did you learn anything about grape culture?
Well, the one thing I know that is red and white wines is not what color the grape is, but whether or not you leave the skins on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting stuff.
The Bible says they have to be pruned or will not produce one.
Yeah, does anybody have any experience with that?
With what now?
Pruning. Why you have to prune them?
You take away the branches that don't bear a lot of fruit, so the other branches can bear much fruit.
Yeah, basically a vine can only produce, I think, on four actual branches. So if you have a vine this big, it comes up and there are like 40 branches. You got to cut it back to four, and then you'll get grapes. And that's what they do. That's why they have to prune every year, because they have to always make sure that they only have four or five of these branches coming out. Otherwise, you're going to have nothing but wood. Grape vines would much prefer to produce wood than to produce fruit. any other experience? Go ahead.
For the apples and pears, anyway, I don't know much about grapes, but with a tree, we work on a tree to open up the tree, change the aspect of the tree so the sun hits as many other branches as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's open up to water and sun.
That's interesting, yeah. Hmm. So it really requires a little bit of maintenance to get things to work out.
In Washington, we have to prune until it hurts, until it kills nearly.
Yeah.
We have a lot of growth, and it just takes tremendous pruning here, and you cut it back, and you think this will never grow.
Yeah.
And then it comes again. The more
yeah.
you prune, the better it seems to be.
Isn't that an irony? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that that's always true with grapes.
A lot of study, you recognize a few fruiting spurs, and you recognize the mm-hmm. those water sprouts and the things that won't fruit.
Is that true?
You study the tree.
Uh-huh. Here's someone who knows something about it. someone this morning was talking about having lived in Cyprus. Kathleen, who's on staff, has lived in Cyprus, and she says that it's just stunning the way these vines, grapevines, will grow out of rock and then will bear such an amazing abundance of fruit, just heavy laden with grapes, but it's coming right out of the rocky soil of a place like Cyprus. And I think that's also probably what's going on here in this passage, is that one can think of few plants that would be thought of as more abundant than vineyards and grapes. What do you get from vineyards anyway? What do you do with grapes?
Jelly.
Raisins.
Food? Raisins? What else?
Wine.
Yay!
My favorite use for them.
Do you know that you don't have to do anything to make wine? I mean, the fermenting organism is always there on the grapes, so anytime you would get the juice out of the grape and put it into a bottle, you would, and cork it, you would get wine every time. You don't have to really be very good at this. Is that true? Yeah, I think that's true. You don't have...
It's dirty. Kept at the right temperature.
Kept at the right temperature. Okay. But it's almost as if alcohol, the creation of alcohol is already there. It's not something that we cooked up. And yeah, you don't have to do anything at all. It's just that the juice of the grape produces that.
Take precautions to keep certain bad cooties out?
I don't know.
Would make it
it's possible.
Poisonous?
It's possible.
They use, isn't it oak rum to keep...
Some cases.
They use oak what?
Rums to do...
In other cases, it's stainless steel. In other cases, it's stainless steel.
Yeah, if you go through the modern wineries, they got these big stainless steel vats, and it's really kind of interesting to see. I have a winery that's about 10 miles from my house, and I go up there every once in a while to buy a couple of bottles of wine if we're going to be doing something, and it's just amazing. You go in there, and you can go in there, and they'll show you, and they said, this is this year's batch, this is this year's batch, this is next, you know, this is what we'll be serving next year.
Mm-hmm. When you think of Jesus and you think of wine, what do you think of? The wedding, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the Lord's Supper.
Well, celebration, and the Lord's Supper, right?
Well, I was going to say, Jesus, the true vine of life, but not quite wine.
So wine for Jesus and for people around Jesus really was a drink of joy and of celebration. Somehow it was something. It was a something that made it possible to be joyful, or it was certainly added to the joy. So a vineyard was perhaps the source of a very precious source of communal joy. You know, if you had a good vineyard and you had good wine, you could have a good party and you could really celebrate the gifts that God has given to you. So a vineyard is, I would guess, I mean, I haven't done research on this, but I would guess that a vineyard is just like one of the most wonderful things that you could have. And a vineyard that was a producing vineyard would have been a source of great joy and celebration in a country, in a fairly primitive country, where there wasn't a lot of distractions. I mean, a lot of things that happened were social functions, and so to have a good vineyard would be wonderful.
Well, even now in Israel, you go over there, the symbol, they have all kinds of limousines and all, is of the two spies with the grapes.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yes, and you can buy all kind of figurines and all. So it
That's
still symbolizes prosperity and land of promise.
Great. Well, okay, so we've got that backdrop. Now we read this passage, which frankly is not a celebration, is it? It starts out with a parable. Can you make sense of what the parable is in the first couple of verses? What's, just in a broad sense, what has happened there? Or what's the story?
What's sort of the story of rejection?
Yeah, in what sense? Just tell the story.
Well, I find it a vineyard. The choicest of vines and the fruit. And you didn't take care of it. You rejected them.
Mm-hmm. I did everything that I could to make this vineyard a productive vineyard, and I expected good grapes, and I got
wild
grapes. Now, what are wild grapes? Has anybody ever eaten wild grapes?
Sour.
Sour, yeah.
Small and sour.
Yeah, they're hard and small, tremendously sour. Yeah.
That kind of goes with the video yesterday where they sprayed and they ruined the grapes.
Uh-huh.
So they're not redeemed.
Hmm.
Dangerous.
Yeah.
So that's kind
of like what. Okay, so God is sort of.
He entrusted it. And
mm-hmm.
He sort of thumbed their nose above.
Yeah. So God is trying to produce, give to the people, or to make of the people, a real celebration, a real joyous affirmation. And instead of getting what he had planned, he gets a version of it, but a version which is unpalatable, or it's like a mock version, it's like a plastic version of the organic thing that he had wanted. Deceptive sort of thing. And then he, in verse 3 and 4, the speaker, who is God, asks the people of Jerusalem to enter into him with a kind of, what do you say about this? He says, well, what would you say if you planted this kind of a vineyard and instead of it yielding grapes, you got wild grapes? What more could I have done for it? He's almost like saying, you know, to the people in the grandstands, am I right? You know, am I right? Am I right to be angry about this? What do you say? What do you say? You know, he's very aggressive about it. And then it's sort of proven to be aggressive, because does he give them time to answer?
No.
No, it's just a rhetorical question. Yeah. He's almost like being a lawyer, isn't he? Sort of working the jury.
Yeah, it says here in my footnote, it says, Judah is asked to pass judgment on herself, much as Nathan, through a parable, had David pass judgment on himself.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. And so what's the judgment?
It'll be devoured, trampled down, made waste, not pruned or honed. Briars and thorns will grow up. No rain.
Yeah, but it's pretty devastating, isn't it? It's like boom, 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 boom.
It's almost like just men and washing his hands of the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. They're like, okay, bring in the bulldozers, folks. Enough of this. Is there any sense of hope in verse 7? Do you get any sense of respite or? Anybody get a sense of that? If you were looking for it, could you cook one up?
I think he was looking for the Messiah.
God? Well, perhaps, but in verse 7, if I told you there was hope there, and you had to write an essay on hope in verse 7, and you realized that you didn't believe it was there, but you had to fake it, what would you say?
Well, they said, behold a cry, so maybe he would wait for them to cry out for help.
That's a possibility. I hadn't thought of that, but that's a good possibility.
Well, he looked for those things, for righteousness, for justice, but it sounds like he didn't find it, unfortunately.
Okay, that's what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, at least he was optimistic, he was looking for it.
At least he's telling him what he's looking for.
Yeah.
What he was looking for. And it seems to be in past tense, which doesn't give you a lot of hope. It says, I looked for this and didn't find it, so I'm going to bulldoze the place. But you get a sense also that maybe if you turn back, even at this late stage of the game, there may be a hope. So in this version of the garden, what God wanted in terms of the grapes, in terms of productivity, was what? What did God want to see or find?
Fruit.
What kind of fruit? In verse 7.
Righteousness and justice.
Righteousness and justice. If Israel is the garden, and God is looking for grapes and gets wild grapes, the wild grapes are bloodshed and a cry. I think in that case the cry is opposition to righteousness. So you're looking for righteousness. Instead of that, you get people beating up on each other and crying out or something like that. It's a hunch I have. So the wild grapes are bloodshed and people crying out in alarm. And the grapes that he was looking for would have been justice and righteousness. You know, a garden of a nation where people, without being forced to do it, are living, trying to give justice to other people, and without being threatened by heaven or hell, are trying to live righteous lives. So the idea of the Garden of Eden, that sort of harmony, is here represented in those two words, I think, you know, which are not there. So it really is a kind of wilderness. It's a wilderness of wild grapes as God sees it. The question I want to ask is if this works. I mean, does it work to motivate people by telling them, by showing them what they really are? To let loose on your disappointment against them? How does it work? Has it worked for you? Have you ever been motivated to change by someone telling you how bad things are, or how dismal you look? There's a lot of this in the prophets, you know, sort of like condemning the people, or confronting the people, and showing them. It looks like holding up a mirror to them and showing them how they look from God's point of view.
Well, Paul did that with the church of Corinth. He just, you know, in his first letter to them, I mean, he just lambasted them. You guys are just not doing it. You know, and he really looked. He was really looking for them to change.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it works when there's just a little hair of hope in there. That, you know, I'm not thinking biblically, but just if someone were to come to me and say, did this, and this wrong, while you disagree at home. You know, and sometimes people aren't motivated to change by that, they just feel worse. But if there's even a little bit
A shred of hope or possibility of change. The other thing that might be operative here is that the images are images of abundance. And so God is showing in this, the voice of God is talking about a possible abundance that is just not there. You know, God isn't talking about a dump heap. God is talking here about a garden. I planted a garden. He even starts out, let me sing for my beloved a love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard. It's like God's, you could see God as just really brokenhearted. The image of the garden is one of a possible abundance, which is not there. Clearly the people who would hear this would be thinking about the promised land, the land of milk and honey, all of the things that God has done for us and given to us, and what have we produced out of this. So there's maybe a memory, a sort of a corporate memory of the promise of green, promise of growth and the promise of abundance, and God sort of laying it out, saying how angry God is. One needs to say that at this time, when Isaiah is preaching, the threat of military overtake of Judah being overwhelmed by its own weakness and by the other people in the Middle East is very great. So you don't hear this kind of talk so much in religious circles today, some fundamentalist circles perhaps, but not mainline circles. Where you do hear it is in the military circles, where people say, unless you spend $5 billion on Star Wars and you spend, you know, $8 billion on the B-1 bomber, the Russians are going to overwhelm us. They're going to come in. This country is a wonderful country. It's the bastion of democracy and hope and peace in the world. And if you don't take care of it, it's going to be wiped out. Let's get cracking. And the money does flow. So in that kind of a context, when we feel threatened as a people or as a country, this kind of rhetoric really does work, the rhetoric of threat, the rhetoric of loss. You're going to lose what you've got if you don't get your act together. It doesn't motivate, though, very much, I think, along religious lines. Because God as a punishing God is also kind of frightening to us.
Would this still be considered God as Yahweh? It wasn't having the Hebrew word.
This is Yahweh.
The judgmental God.
Well, that's a Lutheran rereading of the Old Testament. I mean, in the Old Testament, from the Old Testament point of view, Yahweh is both a mother and a father, is a kind caretaker, keeper of the covenant, as well as a righteous judge. There is a little bit more emphasis in the Old Testament, and the justice that we actually could have reached, but have failed to reach, and so there's judgment.
Don't you think, though, that God, we're pretty much less to judge ourselves in our actions, and as we get deeper and deeper into our sin or whatever, is that we pretty much judged ourselves and we're going to bear the consequences of that sin?
Yeah, there is that aspect to it, right? But sometimes we are so caught up in our own self-centeredness that we don't judge ourselves. And so God comes in and does that, at least in the Old Testament. God sort of shakes people up and tries to force them to see what they're doing.
Well, he obviously did that with the nations of Israel and Judah, because they kept Jeremiah is weeping over that.
Yeah.
Saying, come on, get it together. They're going to come in.
Yeah.
He's going to let them come in. They're going to destroy you.
Yeah. Well, I want to move along and move from this particular vineyard to another vineyard. But let's just think about the intervening centuries here. What happens after the ministry of Isaiah is that, in fact, Babylon comes in and conquers the south in 689, I think, and allows the people to live in Jerusalem for the next 10 years, but the people are real rowdy, and finally Babylon comes in a second time and razes Jerusalem and drags the people off to Babylon. But Babylon is different from Assyria, because Assyria forced the women to intermarry with the men, and the Jews disappeared. When Babylon conquered the southern two tribes, Jerusalem area, carted the people off to Babylon, they allowed them to live in a ghetto in Babylon, and Ezekiel ministered to them there. And so they did not intermarry. And 60 years later, when Cyrus came and took Babylon over, Cyrus said, go home. Anybody who wants to leave, you can leave. And the Jews, in fact, made the trek back across the desert and reestablished Jerusalem. During the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, they rebuilt the city, rebuilt the temple. But shortly after that, the Greeks under Alexander the Great came in, and he conquered the whole Middle East and held it for a while. And then I believe the next occupation was by the Romans about 100 years before Christ. And then we come to Jesus. Now you can see that the idea of the garden doesn't have a lot of room to grow in those years. After Isaiah, there's nothing but conquering, devastation, hard times, occupation by foreign powers. And Jesus comes along and speaks to the issue of the chaos in the garden. I'd like to look at the book of John, chapter 15, verses 1-11. Someone like to read that from 1-11?
Jesus
My true vine, my father's a vine dresser. Every branch of mine that bears no fruit, he takes away, and every branch that does bear fruit, proves it may bear no fruit. You are already made clean by the word which I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me, and I in him, he is that bears much fruit, for apart from me, you can do nothing. The man does not abide in me, he is cast forth as a branch, withers, the branches are gathered, thrown into the fire, and burned. You abide in me, and my words abide in you. Ask whatever you will, and it shall be done for you. By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit, so prove to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be full.
So, what kind of a feel do you get from this vineyard compared to the other?
There's more hope.
There's more hope here, yeah.
There's joy.
Yeah, he talks about joy. Joy being complete.
And our abundance.
Provision.
Hmm?
Provision.
Continuing sense of connectedness.
Let's start with that. Now, we don't really talk about the whole vineyard. What do we talk about? The vine. And who's the vine?
Jesus.
Okay, now Jesus is the vine. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Instead of God saying, look, I gave you a shot at production. I planted you all there. And I was looking for grapes. And I got wild grapes. And I'm bringing in the bulldozers. You have a whole different sense. Now, where is God and Jesus getting involved in this vineyard? Where do they get involved? They're right in the thick of things, right? God is still sort of the vine dresser who's putting the whole thing together, setting up the garden. But suddenly we have Jesus as the vine. So where we have utterly failed to produce the grapes that God desires, which is righteousness and justice in Isaiah. Suddenly you have God saying, okay, maybe these folks can't pull it off. Maybe what I need to do is I need to interpose myself as the vine. Well, where does that put all of us in this second parable? Okay, we're the branches, and what's our main job? Mm-mm. Abide. Our main job is to abide, I think. Well, abide and then secondarily, perhaps, to bear fruit. And what does that mean, abide?
Follow.
Be with.
Tuned in.
Tuned in, connected.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the image that Jesus is proposing here, if we are the branches and he is the vine, what does abide mean in the context of that image?
Joined,
yeah. There's an actual joining. I mean, there's an actual connection and sharing of fluid which gives life.
And growth. If the branch falls off,
there'd be no growth, right? If so, you can't be an independent branch. There's no way to be an independent entity in this particular vineyard.
It's a contradiction in terms to be an independent branch.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So Jesus is using an image here that's really radically different from the way we think of ourselves as being independent or having choices that we need to make and decisions we need to make. Jesus is saying that you don't have anything unless you are connected to the vine. Right? That's pretty striking. And so this abide motif is almost it's begging people or inviting people to live so closely to Jesus that it would be like they were branches of Jesus, the vine. Now, it's an interesting. What's the interdependence here?
It's a branch can have their fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine.
Okay, and what about the vine? Just to say your sentence and use the vine as a subject. A vine can't bear fruit unless it has the branches.
So those branches, yeah. Okay.
Right. Now, isn't that interesting?
In the connection with the single stick, this is kind of a strange thing, but I just read this week in Wangren, you know, his book, that he compared it to the unity of man and woman.
The vine and the branches?
I mean, compared to this, to be Christ, to be connected, the connectedness and unity in a marriage.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And he connected that as our connection to Christ and our coming to Christ.
Mm-hmm.
It's planted, and we cannot bear fruit unless we are connected.
It's
kind of a strange. Not maybe a strange way to look at it, but it hit me because that's just what I just read.
Well, it's almost as if we need to be in the garden. We need the garden to be restored, the garden which we were given at the beginning and which by our disobedience we failed to keep. And in the Old Testament, we were given a garden, or the people of Israel were given a garden, namely the Promised Land, and all they needed to do was to have justice and be righteous, and instead of that, they had bloodshed and a cry of despair, a cry of alarm. And so, indeed, what happened in the course of time, I don't know if God did this or if it just happened, the Promised Land was sort of wiped out, and it was just made into a vassal state of Rome, finally. And then comes Jesus, who says, the garden is still possible. It is possible to bear abundant fruit if you abide in the vine, abide in Christ.
You know, it's something you just said there that kind of woke up something that I was thinking. And you remember the song Woodstock? When, you know, their whole emphasis was gotta get back to the garden.
Yeah. Get ourselves back to the garden.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, a really naive way of looking at. I mean,
we're looking for a utopia.
Sense in the '60s that if everybody let their hair grow long, that somehow you know, we would get to a place of justice and righteousness again.
That was all about.
Gil, you didn't let your hair grow. Gil, you didn't let your hair grow. He was the problem. I don't believe it. We were all walking around with long hair and you were shaving your face.
I didn't grow hair.
Too late.
How could all that be reduced to one sentence?
Which?
The 60s.
Oh, yeah, right. I'm sorry. I was there. I enjoyed it, actually.
That was you.
What about this pruning? What happens with the pruning? Now, there's a little judgment here, isn't there? How does this judgment work? Any branch that does not bear fruit, my Father prunes, right? And every branch that it does bear fruit, he prunes that it may bear more fruit. So nobody gets away without getting pruned. It's not like the good guys don't get pruned and the bad guys get thrown into the fire. It's more like everybody gets pruned. Some get more radically pruned than others. There's judgment. It's not judgment, it's not selective judgment, it's judgment across the board. Anything else about judgment in here?
Prune a branch off the vine, it gets burned. But if prune us off the vine, what happens? Grow in despair.
I think he cuts part of us off, I'm not sure. I think that's what pruning is. You cut part and then we are able to produce. It's down in verse 6, where he says, if someone doesn't abide in me, that one is cast forth as a branch and withers. Branches are gathered, thrown into the fire, and burned. So if we try to live lives that are not connected to the source of life, I guess what that means is that we end up being outside of the garden. We end up being part of the trash pile or something. It's a fairly harsh thing, I think.
Our trash pile, human trash pile, is abundant now, I'd say.
Mm. It's hard to know. I mean, we don't know who's there, you know? The judgment is mine, says the Lord, so... to get back to the idea of abide, what does abide mean? Does it mean go to church? Does it mean be baptized? Does it mean do justice every day? Does it mean walk humbly with God? You know, to abide is...
carry on that relationship. It does not, you don't have to be in a church to carry on that relationship with God, but it helps.
Okay, to be in relationship with God, another way to think of that is to be intimate, yeah. Or to have your heart open to God. Perhaps have your heart open to the concerns that God has, which are concerns of justice and righteousness and peacefulness.
And that only comes through the word and prayer, really. I mean, it has to come through the Spirit's working to you, the word and prayer.
Yep. Spirit
and
working.
That's where it's so easy to forget that sometimes. To be working without the source of that strength, which is the abiding in them, isn't it? We can't abide in him if we aren't in the word or in prayer.
Well, he says that the word is what does he say? You are already made clean by the word which I've spoken to you. This is a nice comforting statement. The disciples, this is happening in the upper room. Jesus has just washed their feet and is speaking to them on Thursday night before he's going to the cross. And so they've been eating and drinking and talking about what's going to happen. And he says, says to the people on the table, you're already made clean by the word I've spoken to you. So it's a sort of comforting word to them, because they of course are saying, oh my God, am I one of the branches that's going to be cast forth? And he says, no, the word that I've spoken to you has made you clean. Which is a nice thing. The gospel somehow makes us clean, or somehow prunes some of the dead wood from us and helps us to be more productive.
If we jump down to verse 16, it's kind of answers what we were talking about too. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, that your fruit should be remain, and whatever you ask the Father in my name, he will give you. Mm-hmm. That kind of sums up to me what this is getting at.
Yeah, he says that again, ask whatever you will in verse 7, and it shall be done for you.
But he doesn't say the Father's name, though, in my name.
Yeah.
In my name, though.
Right. Mm-hmm. But it's a idea that as we abide in Jesus, we really are part of Jesus. And just to go back and touch on that again, that Jesus needs us to bear fruit. Jesus can't bear fruit without us. The vine can't bear fruit. The branches are the ones that bear the fruit. But the vines cannot exist by themselves. So there's this radical kind of partnership that Jesus is suggesting in this garden that God has made in the midst of the chaos. That Jesus needs us, and we need Jesus, and the abiding that happens goes both ways. We don't have the sense that God is sitting in the cab of a bulldozer about to take, run us down, but rather that God is opening himself in Jesus to the fact that the mission is being carried on by us. We are the ones that are bearing the fruit. That Jesus is the one who's sustaining us and empowering us and providing us with the hope, the truth, but we're the ones that are actually doing the work out there. By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit, and so prove to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, this is verse 9, so have I loved you? Abide in my love. Now there again, you get the sense that the love and the vine are similar. You abide in the vine, you abide in the love. That what comes from Jesus to us is God's love. We come to recognize God's love when we stay close to Jesus. We see how much Jesus... How do we see that? We see how much Jesus entrusted himself to God. And we see that God did not fail Jesus. And that serves to us as a kind of example and inspiration so that we too can open ourselves up to God in the same way. We are connected in that sense through Jesus to God. It's a very wonderful passage. And then he goes into commandments. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love. Just as I kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. I like that because it's a different sense of commandments, isn't it? It's not like you have to keep the commandments first and then you get some connection with God. It's more like Jesus says, well, folks, if you stay close to me, you will bear fruit. Furthermore, if you love the way I loved, that's what it means to stay close to me and bear fruit. Furthermore, if you do those things, what you're actually doing is keeping the commandments. See? So love becomes a sort of prior thing to keeping the commandments instead of saying you've got to keep the Ten Commandments, you've got to keep the 600 Jewish laws in order then to be close to God. It's a much more organic way of understanding God's law and God's judgment, that the law and the judgment are really a way of keeping us in touch with the love of God so that we can bear fruit. It's sort of looking at the upside of things instead of the downside. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you. That's really nice. And that your joy may be full. This is Jesus the night before he's going to be crucified. So you could see God's God taking on a new tactic, as it were. Instead of allowing the people to either stand or fall on their own feet, God enters into the chaos of the garden. Jesus, on the road to his death, is explaining how the disciples need to be connected to him in order that the garden of Israel might flourish. And this is a garden which is established in love rather than in commandments. Though the commandments need to be there, you can't have love without law. You really can't. You can't have gospel without law. You need to have the two of them. But it's very important in any kind of witnessing that you do, for example, I think you always have to start with a deep connection to the person that you're talking to, that person knows that you're turning toward them out of love rather than simply out of wanting to control them or give them some new information or something. I think that we learn from the New Testament that God's way of trying to connect with us is a way of trying to touch our hearts and then lead us into an understanding of the way the world works, that there are laws in the world, that if you engage in acts of war, you're going to become a warlike people, or if you give up your life for peace, that may in fact increase the amount of peace in the world. Miraculous laws that actually follow. I want to read one thing from... One note that I want to say before I turn from this is, this is my favorite passage for weddings. I usually give couples about 7 or 8 New Testament gospel passages that they can choose from. And I always sort of say a little prayer under my breath that they'll choose this one, because I like to talk. I like to talk about the kinds of weddings. I've been to a number of weddings. I've been to a lot of weddings that I do, but weddings that I don't do. Sometimes the preacher doesn't say anything, which I think is awful. Not to say something at a wedding. I think because couples are nervous and because they want to get everything done on time, and so they want a 20-minute wedding. Other weddings that I've been to where the preacher's focus has been on the couple and on the love that the couple has, I think that that's the worst possible solution. It would be better to talk about the weather than to talk about the love that the couple has as a sign of of God's love. That's completely reversed. And the reason I think that that's dangerous is because I know for a fact that oftentimes couples are really nervous and really wondering, is this the right thing? And do I really love this guy? And here's my whole family and all my friends and everybody I've ever known and two old boyfriends. And you know, and I'm looking around and I'm thinking, do I really want to marry this guy or not? You know? And then the preacher walks into the pulpit and says, you know, the love that you have for each other and the constancy and the certainty that you have about each other is a sign of God's love for us. And he's like, no.
That's a good point.
So the point that I like to make from this is that we find who we are as lovers and as couple, members of a couple, that real unity that we see in the garden between Adam and Eve, that we discover that again in Christ, when Christ is the vine and we are branches bearing fruit, because I think that marriage is a place where fruit is born, not just metaphorically children, but also the idea of a couple's love for one another being a real sign of God's love to the world. But it has to be rooted in Christ in order to be solid, and I like to talk about their intimacy with Christ rather than as a couple, rather than their intimacy with each other being a sign of Christ. It's a technicality, but I think important. And I want to read something from Buechner again to push this, my favorite author. It's in a book called Wishful Thinking, a Theological ABC. He does work on a lot of different theological words in here: prophet, riches, poverty, minister, Messiah, memory, laughter, judgment, healing. I'm going to read judgment because I think it's wonderful. Judgment. We are judged. We are all of us judged every day. We are judged by the face that looks back at us from the bathroom mirror. We are judged by the faces of people we love and by the faces and lives of our children and by our dreams. Each day finds us at the junction of many roads, and we are judged as much by the roads we have not taken as by the roads we have. The New Testament proclaims that at some unforeseeable time in the future, God will ring down the final curtain on history, and there will come a day on which all of our days and all of the judgments upon us and all of our judgments upon each other will themselves be judged. The judge will be Christ. In other words, the one who judges us most finally will be the one who loves us most fully. Romantic love is blind to everything except what is lovable and lovely. But Christ's love sees us with terrible clarity and sees us whole. Christ's love so wishes our joy that it is ruthless against everything in us that diminishes that joy. The worst sentence love can pass is that we behold the suffering which love has endured for our sake, and that is also our acquittal. That's a hard sentence. Let me read it again. Look, whenever I say love, hear Christ. The worst sentence love, Christ, can pass is that we behold the suffering which love, Christ, has endured for our sake, and that is also our acquittal. The sentence is our acquittal. The justice and mercy of the judge are ultimately won. The justice and the mercy of the judge are ultimately won.
What is your passage that you use?
Which passage do I use? I use 15, 1 to 17.
15, 1 to 17.
Yeah, the couple chooses, actually. They choose 15, 12 to 15. 12 to 14, 15. And then oftentimes I just get inspired and read the whole chapter, and they sit there in the front row going, what? Wishful thinking.